AUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. FEMA officials say many of the victims of the Maui wildfires died in their homes. CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti is on Maui, where searchers believe it may take years to identify all the remains.
Harrowing video shows people on Maui desperately seeking refuge in a pool as an inferno burned all around them during last week's wildfires. And now, as FEMA crews continue the grueling search for victims, it's becoming clear many were either unaware or had little chance to escape the fast-approaching flames.
Where are you finding most of the remains?
Anywhere where there's a bed.
People were asleep.
People were asleep. People were in various stages of fleeing their location.
Meantime, Hawaii's governor vows to protect Maui from developers. Some locals report receiving cash offers for land destroyed by fires. Thousands of people are being evacuated from Yellowknife, the capital of Canada's Northwest Territories, due to an approaching wildfire. Some 1,000 wildfires are burning in Canada. Jeff Amey with the Canada Ministry of Health.
We are starting to draw all kinds of health associations between fine particulate matter and health outcomes, such as, you know, the ones you would think about, cardiovascular issues. Right. But there's an association that we're seeing with diabetes. There's an association that we're seeing with low birth weight.
CBS's Scott McFarlane has the latest on plea negotiations with 9/11 defendants.
There's now fresh outrage for Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband died in the World Trade Center after the Pentagon sent this letter to families revealing plea deals are being considered in which the five men would accept criminal responsibility for their actions and plead guilty in exchange for not receiving the death penalty.
I thought I lived in the United States of America. I thought we were a nation based upon the rule of law. And obviously, that's turned out not to be the case.
Hurricane Hilary is churning a few hundred miles off Mexico's coast. It's projected to hit California by early Monday and move up to the California-Nevada-Oregon state lines by Tuesday. CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson.
It's incredibly rare. So the last time that we had a landfalling tropical storm in Southern California would have been 1939. That's before we named storms. So that gives you an indication of how long ago it was.
A Taliban official from Afghanistan's Ministry of Vice and Virtue says women lose value if men can see their faces in public. More from CBS's Christopher Cruz.
The official says the only proper way for a woman to wear the hijab, the Islamic headscarf, is if their face is hidden. The Taliban, which took over Afghanistan 2 years ago, has said the failure of women to cover their face in public is the reason the government has barred them from most public spaces and from having a job or attending college.
This is CBS News.
Hire with minimal effort and max speed with Indeed. Their hiring solution platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. Your basement might have gotten wet, but the heavy downpour Monday did help improve the dryness problem in the area. The drought monitor has been updated.
Some slight improvements in the drought conditions in southeastern parts of the state after soaking rains fell into Milwaukee and Madison areas earlier this week. This shrunk the extreme drought region by a third. Still, over 78% of the state remains in a drought, though, down from 82% last week. Conditions got a little worse into the Northwoods in Ashland and Iron counties. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot, Civic Media News.
The search for a missing Cudahy man has come to a sad end. Police say 42-year-old David Alley has been found deceased. No further details about the discovery are available. He was last seen near St. Luke's in July. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
A perfect day starts with perfect breakfast. Start your day with Brunch It Up. Our experts are serving up the ultimate brunch experience. Our menu is loaded with inventive dishes from chicken and waffles to cinnamon roll pancakes. Try unique cocktails like Brunch Bloody Mary with house-infused vodka. Come brunch it up over bottomless mimosas or a midday pick-me-up or with the whole family for an unforgettable Sunday brunch. Brunch It Up in Milwaukee, Brookfield, or Cedarburg from 7 to 3 on weekdays and 8 to 3 on weekends. Let's brunch it up.
It's summertime in Wisconsin, and whatever the weather, it will impact you and your plans.
Should I water the garden? Will our event be rained out? Count on your local Civic Media radio station for in-depth details and the most up-to-date forecast.
Temperatures are rising into the mid and upper 70s under sunny skies.
It's your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Jobs boom, a clean energy boom. Sounds like a good idea to me. For much more on all of these booms and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter, at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. I got to start with probably the funniest story I saw all day. And look, you know, if I'm being accused of a crime, if I've been indicted, maybe I try this tact. But according to the AP, Donald Trump's lawyers have asked a federal judge to schedule trial for April of 2026. April of 2026. Now, look, you know, I'm going... who knows? He may not even be alive in 2026. But the DOJ is asking for a January, this coming January, a couple months down the road. The Trump folks, 2026. Yeah. And look, am I surprised? No, not at all. But what they're saying is, look, you know, sorry, you know, the guy's, he's a busy guy. He's a busy guy. He's got stuff. He's got places to be, things to do, people to see, deals to make, because he's got to surround himself with the best people. I'm guessing that's it. Now, the argument is he's running for president, so we don't want to interfere with that. So I guess if I'm ever accused of a crime, I'm just going to run for something. Instead of running, just run for office. Because, hey, you know, you're disrupting my schedule. Quite amazing stuff. Now, yesterday, I talked about something that evidently... you know, piqued some interest in some, angered some others. I talked about the song North, Rich Man North of Richmond, I guess it's what it's called, by this guy Oliver Arnold, I believe his name is, or Oliver Anthony. Yes. I said I listened to it. I saw that it was getting some attention, and the listservs that I'm on, you know, the people who are much further left politically than I am, basically calling it a Nazi anthem. You know, it's the song of white supremacy, and he's going after, everyone saw what they wanted to see in it. Whatever their colored glasses were, that's what they saw. Whatever silo they found themselves, that's what they saw. And I was simply pointing out that, look, the reality in this day and age is people are angry, people are struggling, people are suffering, things are happening that need to be addressed, and that we do need to to listen to others. We do need to hear the voices of working people. And look, first and foremost, I am not a country music fan by any stretch of the imagination. My wife will attest to that. You know, we've been together a long time. Been married over 23 years now. Been together, you know, 27 some odd years. Never. In fact, one of the first things that came up was, what kind of music do you like? Anything but country was the response. And, well, here we've been together all this time. But here's the thing. Not a fan. Just to put that on the table. Not a fan. Had to do that. But the idea behind it, I'm a supporter of. The idea of working people are struggling, I'm a huge supporter of. So I got a bunch of emails, and I want to go through some of it. Daryl from Minneapolis wrote me an email, said, Rick, you read the lyrics to Rich Man North of Richmond, and I have to tell you, I was so happy to hear your take. Too often we are forced into silos and never actually talk about anything productive. I think you hit the nail on the head when you were talking about Red Hat, Blue Hat. Love that frame, by the way. I saw LeBron James singing along to that song and thought, LeBron James and Rick Smith like it? It must be all right. Keep up the fight, brother. And look, Daryl, again, not a country music fan. It's the message, and it's what's being sent out. It's what we should be hearing. You know, the feeling of this country right now is there's something wrong. People are angry. And we have to address this. And I've said for a very long time, whichever party figures out how to address these concerns and make people feel like they're addressing their needs, they're going to be the dominant party. I think of FDR. You know, people are still talking about, we need to go back to the New Deal and FDR. There needs to be that. Because understand, you watch some of the videos that come out of these rallies and stuff. There are people who are angry. They're saying, we're not Democrats or Republicans. This isn't white or black. This is what I've always said. It's green. It's money. And what the reality is, and the reason we keep hearing a lot of the stuff that we hear, is once we figure out corporate America has been screwing us, they're in trouble. Once the very wealthy are the target instead of each of us, there's going to be problems. Now, I got another email, no name. Rick, I'm disappointed to hear you defending that Richmond song. You know what people like me means, right? This is dog whistle to white supremacist crowd. Do better, Rick. I didn't get that. I guess maybe you can throw that in there somewhere if that's what your view is, what your silo is. I get it. But then I got these emails. Now, understand, I know nothing about Oliver Anthony. All I saw was this song being talked about in this space that I ghost, that I just want to know what people are saying. And this is horrible. This is bad. So I had to go see it. So this person sends me an email, and I'm assuming this photo is of a Facebook post from Oliver Anthony. And on February 24th, 2022, he posts, as an American, I support and stand with Joe Biden. He has changed this country for the better. Those who live off government assistance are parasites to this country. Joe is what a true American is, hardworking and not taking handouts. Those on the right who sit on their backsides and complain about the left are not this country. A true Democrat is this country, and that is Joe. This is the guy who supposedly wrote the white nationalist anthem. Someone else sent me an actual Facebook post, a link to his Facebook page, where he goes through and tells the story of his life. He talks about how he dropped out of high school in 2010 and then got a GED. He talks about working in multiple plants for poverty wages, 6 days a week, third shift. He talks about the struggle. He talks about being injured on the job in 2013, fracturing his skull and can't work for months. He talks about all of this stuff. And this is not unique. This is what working people go through and what I've been talking about for years now. This should be new to none of my listeners. This is the kind of stuff that I've been talking about for, well, coming up on 18 years now. Because this is the life that working people live. He said he got another job where he spent the last 10 years hearing the same story from person after person. And he says, look, I'm tired of it. I'm tired of people being neglected, divided, and manipulated. He said, look, there's nothing special about me. I'm not a very good musician, not a very good person. He says, spent the last 5 years struggling with mental health, using alcohol to drown it out. He just says, look, I just want to see a better country. And I got to tell you, when I listened to that song, that is what I heard. And what I hoped would come out of it is what he says he wants. And that is people to pay attention to who is really dividing us. Look, and you could attack me. I've been attacked over this before. As someone who was humiliated having to use food stamps as a kid because my mother could not find employment or childcare or any of that, I am dead set against handout programs. I want jobs programs. My mother wanted a job. My mother needed healthcare. I want policies that are going to move in this direction so that we don't have these humiliation moments. We don't have these divisive moments. And I've said for years, government should be the employer of last resort, bottom line. You need a job? You need to put food on the table? You're going to get one. But no, we're not going to get that from our Republican friends. And again, I come back to, saw this information today. CEOs from 300 of the healthcare companies in this country, the top 300 CEOs of publicly traded healthcare. Now remember, we're told, well, healthcare is all nonprofit. Nonsense. Their combined salary in 2022 was $4 billion. $4 billion over 300 people. You're talking over $13 million a person here, with the top guy being, or the top, actually, woman, being the head of Moderna, pocketing $394 million. You want to be mad at something? Be mad at that person. Be mad at this system. Now, look, the welfare person who he went after eating the fudge rounds, yeah, you go, hey, I don't agree with that. The welfare queen that I want to go after, the parasite that I want us to go after, are these CEOs who are stealing healthcare dollars that should be taking care of people instead of lining their pockets. See, I'm a policy person, always have been. Sound policy, smart investment. That's how we rebuild the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. And I come back to where this has to be political. The Republican Party has shown me nothing that they give a rat's behind about any working person. What policy have they moved forth that's going to help us? Let's take school lunches, for example. Something very simple, something that benefits the working class of this country, something that I benefited from as a child. They want to do away with universal lunch programs. It's in the Republican Study Committee's report. Want to do away with that. Kids, if they're hungry, they'll go in and clean the bathroom, pull themselves up by the bootstraps. You just had Josh Shapiro, who's just signed the law here in Pennsylvania guaranteeing breakfast and lunch for students in this state. That is a good thing. Republicans want means testing of lunch programs because, you know, we don't want anyone undeserving to eat. And I like what Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said. He said, look, the haves and the have-nots in the school lunchroom is not necessarily the thing. Just feed our children. Give them the dignity of just being able to eat. In the wealthiest country in the history of civilization, can we at least do that? And then maybe we start. We're reaching out to this Oliver Anthony to try and get him on the show because I think this guy can be helpful. Because someone like this can, in fact, go into those crowds and talk about the things that he's written, the things that we talk about here on this show. It's possible. We just have to do it. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
We'll be right back. We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, I'm still stuck on the Trump lawyers going, yeah, we'll start trial. Let's book April of 2026. Let's do that. Wow. I don't know how you do that with a straight face. I don't. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And I wanted to talk about the connections between, say, for instance, country music as an art form and what you were referring to in terms of what position it has in terms of our culture and in terms of the working class movement. I would argue that more so than any other musical form, it has ties to the working class movement in a way that no other form does. And for generations, you know, these were the artists that were singing about the plight of the working man. And what they owed to the system and how they couldn't get ahead and how you get paid and go back and give it all to the company store, and this was the kind of art form that helped to bring many of these people to unions and bought them to the Democratic Party. But as union strength has eroded and union membership has declined, Republicans have been successfully able to peel these people off. Based on a number of different tactics, not the least of which are things like social issues, single voter issues like abortion and gun rights and so forth. And because let's face it, these individuals who are from the old Rust Belt and part of the South, they were never voting Democrat because of our positions on race, on gender, on sexual orientation, none of these things. You know, as a matter of fact, they would hold their nose on those issues and vote for us. In many ways. So when they no longer saw themselves as being represented by the Democrats, because again, the unions were no longer serving the same role that they did, say in 1970 in this country, then they felt they had no allegiance to the Democratic Party, and it allowed the Republican Party to peel them away. So and you're absolutely correct. The question is, how do we get them back to realizing that their interest lies in the same camp as other people who may not look like them? They might not go to the same church, they might not be the same skin color, they might not be of the same ethnic origin, but nonetheless they are all in the same pot when it comes to being part of the working class or working poor in this country, or even the middle class. And yet somehow Republicans have convinced them that they have more in common with a CEO than they do with some guy who is a different color or ethnicity who lives across the street from them.
No, you're spot on. And this is the mastery of what Republicans have done. And I got to tell you, the failure of the Democratic Party to give them a reason. And you're spot on right. And I go back to the Clinton era. You know, as people were losing their factory jobs, this, hey, just go get an education, that doesn't fly. Because, you know, what are you going to do with somebody in their 50s who had a job making 70, 80 grand a year? Now you're going to train them to go back to almost minimum wage? That's a slap in the face.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not sure how we get them back in light of a global economic dynamic. I don't want to go too deep in the woods with this, but I contend that part of what we came to realize was the American dream coming out of the Great Depression and really going to, say, about the mid-1970s, early 1980s. You had a couple of generations of what we identify today as the American dream. You could come out of high school, mediocre education, go to work in a steel plant here in on the south side of Chicago, as my father did, and raise four children. You could send them to college, you could retire. That was a dream that lasted a couple of generations until it started to fade. And largely because, you know, after coming out of the Second World War, the United States produced 51% of all the goods and services on the planet. So I want people to understand and to get a perspective of what that meant in 1945.
Right.
And then to go forward, obviously, that declined over time. And the people that they saw their industries decimated in Europe. Japan saw its industry decimated. Well, over the next 30 years, they rebuilt their industries to modern standards. We in America, we didn't. Instead, corporate America here, the big three in Detroit, thought that they would reign supreme for centuries to come in the auto industry and could build junk and pocket money because they thought everybody was going to buy American until the end of time. Well, that didn't happen because other car manufacturers built better things and cars that people actually wanted, and they came to realize that a bit too late. So I don't know what the answer is because, again, we're living in a global economy, and now no matter who you are, with the exception of a few industries, you have to compete in an international marketplace. And how do we then do that?
Well, I think what Biden is doing with some of the policies to reshore manufacturing and government investment in new technology, I think that's a smart first step. It's going to help us build an industrial base that's going to move us in that direction. And I understand what you're saying, that the globe was void of a lot of manufacturing, but we're also the planet's largest consumer. So if my ideal of domestic production for domestic consumption, I think you start there.
Oh, and you're absolutely right. Now, obviously, what the plan is, in terms of what you're talking about, is very different than what you see manifested in the real world economy. In the real world economy, CEOs and division heads and so forth, they all are under pressure to minimize costs,
yep.
Which, let's face it, the single largest cost is labor. So in other words, if we could automate, if we could offshore, if we could do any of these things to minimize costs, then obviously we can maximize profits. The problem is, but if you spread that out over the entire economy, because you're not the only one to think of this, that sooner or later you run out of people who you want to sell things to because they no longer have jobs and therefore cannot buy the things you're selling. The way in which, things worked for much of the 20th century was American workers made a good living and bought a lot of things with the money that they made.
Yep.
And all of us prospered under that system. But what happens when you don't need workers anymore, or you need them at such a minimum rate of pay, such that, and then you expand that over the entire economy. Okay, who's buying what you're selling now?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I couldn't have said it better myself. Good stuff, Steve. I mean, I'm right there with you. I mean, the idea that if workers don't have wages, and this is what I fear about automation and robotics, when people are no longer needed, who buys the widgets and the whatnots? You're right. Appreciate
Absolutely.
The call, man.
And if I could make this, if I could make this one last point, I do think there is an additional conundrum here in that, the quote-unquote American dream, if the entire world lived like the average American lives, we would need 2 to 3 additional planet Earth. So we do have to start asking ourselves, even if we could go back to our grandfather's day of consumption in terms of where America stood versus the rest of the world, we don't have the resources on this planet for everybody to live the way that we used to. Not because the rest of the world didn't stand still. They came out of poverty, including in China and India and so forth. So how do we then reconcile that?
It's a good question. Something I'm sure you've got. You got an answer for that real quick?
I have no answer for that because, again, where do you get those resources?
I'm with you. I got to move on. I got to get one more call before the break. I appreciate the call, Steve, though. Thanks so much. Let's go to Alice real quick. Got a minute for you, Alice. What's on your mind?
What I wanted to say was, I think one of the factors that has led to the working class going over to the Republican Party is, in the heyday of the Democratic Party, they were just coming out of the Depression and World War II. And a lot of families had been through extreme poverty and saw that the Republican Party wasn't worried about it. But the Democrats, FDR, et cetera, were trying to make things better. And I think as we hit the 60s and then we went through the, let's get rid of the racism and all this kind of stuff, things kind of switched and the Republicans used their multi-prong attack to take over. That's my theory.
No, it is. And you know, as corporate America was leaving the shores and shedding workers and saying, screw you guys, you're on your own, and pocketing massive amounts of profit, they left people behind. And that's where I come back to this song and the feeling that this guy's got, that, you know, it's a struggle. And it's not just him. It's a lot of working people. There's a lot of working class angst out there. But I appreciate the call, Alice. Thank you. Seriously, I mean, I'm curious how you see this. And please email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com, even if you disagree with me. Because I think someone has to break this divide. We've been going into places and talking to people for years about just this, about making lives better. So my true north is always, how do we make working people's lives better? How do we make sure that people can afford a roof over their head and food on the table, so that that kid growing up in the housing project that I grew up in at least has the same opportunities that I had, and doesn't have to endure the same kind of humiliation and the same kind of nonsense that I had to go through? We can make people's lives better. Isn't that what we should be striving for? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1978. That was the day President Jimmy Carter declared a federal health emergency at Love Canal in the city of Niagara Falls, New York. Premier spokeswoman, housewife Lois Gibbs, became the poster child for the citizens' environmental justice movement virtually overnight. Niagara Falls Gazette journalists had broken the story 2 years earlier. Residential sump pump testings and health surveys found a number of toxic chemicals and unusually high rates of cancers, birth defects, miscarriages, and other serious health concerns. Initially planned as a canal, the site remained abandoned until the 1940s. That's when Hooker Electrochemical Plant and the city began using the site to dispose of toxic chemicals and municipal waste. More than 20,000 tons of toxic sludge containing more than 21,000 chemicals were buried there. Then, in 1953, the city school board bought the site and built two schools on the property. Soon, about 1,000 families settled nearby. By the early 1970s, residents complained of foul odors, health issues, substances filling their basements, and leaky waste disposal drums popping up in their backyards, killing all plant life. Carter's initial declaration provided limited funding, but the disaster led to the passage of the Superfund Act. The neighborhood was demolished, and residents were compensated and relocated. The new owner of Hooker Chemical, Occidental Petroleum, settled with the EPA for $129 million. Despite 21 years of remediation and residential redevelopment, new residents complained in 2011 of foul odors and ruptured sewer lines oozing toxic sludge. By 2014, 1,000 new complaints had been filed, contending the area had never been properly remediated. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
When your political opponents push extremist public policies that would be disastrous for America, should you wring your hands in dread or applaud? Consider Project 2025, put together by former Trump officials and the Koch brothers' network of billionaire plutocrats. Their strategy is to win the presidency next year by demonizing all environmental protections and promising to halt all national efforts to cope with the obvious crises of climate change. Their proposals include repealing regulations that curb fossil fuel pollution, terminating our nation's transition to renewable energy, shutting down all environmental protection agencies, encouraging more oil and gas use, and promoting the deadly delusion that global warming is not a real problem. Moreover, they intend to implement Project 2025 in the first 180 days of a right-wing Republican presidential term, obviously anticipating that Donald Trump will be that president. "We're not tinkering at the edges," brags a far-out right-wing group that instigated the scheme. "We are writing a battle plan, and we are marshaling our forces." They've already drawn up a list of agencies and policies they'll begin eliminating on day one, and they've readied a list of some 20,000 right-wing henchmen to put on the federal payroll immediately to enforce their plan. If this sounds ludicrous, it is, but it's actually happening. For the Republican Party has decided to be ludicrous. As the director of Project 2025 told the New York Times, This is where the conservative movement sits at this time. This is Jim Hightower saying, maybe, but it damn sure won't sit well with the American people, who are presently suffering the hellish ravages of our rapidly overheating climate. Indeed, here's a great chance for Democrats to demonstrate their bipartisan spirit by doing all they can to publicize the Republicans' let-it-burn global warming policy.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're celebrating the one-year anniversary of the signing of the Inflation Reduction Act. If you look at some of the numbers, it's there's truth in advertising. Inflation has come down. Jobs are being created. We're in the middle of what it could be an energy boom, a clean energy boom. And it has everything to do with the fact that Biden was able to get that Inflation Reduction Act passed. Something that I had numerous people tell me, and I got to be honest, I was one of them thinking, never going to happen. I never thought Manchin or Sinema or any of them would come along. But got it done, and things are happening. Jobs are being created. Communities are getting better. Good stuff. And here to share some thoughts on just how good, I've asked Cynthia Finney to come talk with us. She's the president of the Maine AFL-CIO. You can check out their website, maineaflcio.org. Cynthia, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at the one-year anniversary, and I'm going, you know, how fast can you get the money out the door? How fast can these projects ramp up? You know, what's going on in Maine? What projects are you seeing? What's going on?
Well, you pass a bill, and you want everything to happen right away, but then there's the rulemaking and all of that. But it's coming, and one of the things that has happened right away is that the labor standards in those bills, in that bill, has allowed us in our work to build out offshore wind as we look at trying to do Maine's part in fending off climate change. Because of the standards in that bill, we were able to get an offshore wind bill for Maine. It's going to ensure that as we build these jobs in the clean energy climate that you just talked about, the clean energy economy, that those are good jobs that have good wages and good benefits. And it was the Inflation Reduction Act provisions that allowed us to assure people that we could set high standards for how big the projects were going to be and how soon we're going to be able to do them in our offshore wind bill that we passed in the state legislature.
Yeah, what I love is they kept Davis-Bacon in there. Republicans tried to get it ripped out. They were able to keep it in there. Also, you know, just recently, and I'm sure you know this as well as anyone, the president came out and said we're going back to the pre-Reagan era, ideal of Davis-Bacon, which means more good jobs for more workers and better opportunities for communities. So for a state like Maine that, I got to tell you, last time I was there almost blew me off the shore, lots of wind energy projects have got to be coming up and down your shore.
Yeah, offshore wind is going to be a big thing. And, of course, in Maine, you know, if you were here, especially if you were here as a tourist, you know about the importance of the lobster industry. And so we were really pleased to be able to put together a coalition and include in our offshore wind bill protection for the Lobster Management Area 1, which is one of the primary fishing areas for that, to preserve the culture, the history, and the economy that goes along with that. So, again, really strong bill that we're proud of to be making those changes. Now, and those Davis-Bacon provisions that you mentioned that are going to create, high standards. So the bidders have to actually create jobs with good wages and good benefits. They can't just come in as the low bidder and rake off the profits from this. You know, it's our tax money. We want it spent to create something that's going to benefit the whole community.
Absolutely. You know, I've been saying for the longest time on this issue is that, you know, if we're using our tax dollars to get the things that we need, it should benefit the community in more ways than just getting the cheap thing. But, you know, there's this moment where I look at Joe Biden and I go, you know, he is, in his words, the most pro-union president in my lifetime. And I agree. And this is one of those examples. And the fact I can't emphasize this enough, that it was put in the Inflation Reduction Act and in the infrastructure bill and mandated to be part of that, so that those jobs would be created and those would be good jobs, so that competition would happen on quality, on getting things done, on efficiency, and not on who's willing to work for pennies. That, to me, is the most important part of it.
Exactly. And it's huge. And it goes way further than anything I can remember in terms of federal support that way, which, again, allows us to then create those standards here in the state. And I can tell you, if you want, I could share a couple of stories of some of the exciting things, you know, individuals that this is.
No, I was just going to ask you, you know, tell me what's going on. What's happening on the ground?
So in anticipation of these clean energy jobs that are being created and also the construction jobs from the infrastructure bill, we're fast-tracking folks into the union apprenticeships to build out those workforces. And we have a pre-apprenticeship program where we're specifically seeking to bring folks who might not find their way to these good jobs on their own and support them into a solid union apprenticeship. So, for example, we've just graduated our second class. We have this one fella, young guy, grew up in poverty, kind of in and out of the justice system as a young person. He worked a lot of what were, in his words, lousy jobs. He felt taken advantage of, felt unvalued. So for a person like him, he's going to have a job now in an organization where they say, you matter, your life matters, or he's going to be getting paid wages that he can live and build a future on. You know, that's one example. We have another young woman who she was in the reentry program coming out of the Maine justice system, and she's going to be starting on Monday. She's got a job lined up. She's going to be going to a job that's going to support her. It's not just going to give her pennies and have her scrambling for assistance elsewhere. It's a job that's going to support her. And through her union benefit program, she's going to have a recovery program built into the benefits that's going to support her through her transition back from the justice system and, you know, the bad breaks that took her there and the hard times she's had, and give her a future. And we're pretty excited about that, and so is she.
Yeah, no, look,
and those things are possible because of those standards. So those contractors can bid on those jobs and have a hope of winning them.
Yeah, you know, I've been talking about, you know, telling those stories, oh, I don't know, for all 18 years of doing this show, because I think those are important. You know, when I tell my story about, you know, growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland and seeing that neighbor get that union job as a young kid and seeing their lives get better immediately, so that, you know, at a young age you get that idea of union job, better life. I've been saying for the longest
Absolutely.
Time that needs to happen. And the Department of Labor right now, and I'm sure you know this, they've just launched the Apprentice Trailblazer Initiative to do just what you're saying. Tell those stories, share those stories with people so that you get more people to come to the trades. Because I don't know if you know this, but we're going to need more tradespeople.
We're going to be building a lot of green energy. We're going to be retrofitting buildings, really, really making a shift.
And this, for me, is the way we rebuild our economy in a way that supports
exactly.
a strong middle class, a strong working class, a prosperous working class. You know, we were talking a little bit earlier here in the program about, you know, how do we recreate that era that our grandparents grew up in? And I think, you know, ensuring that these jobs that are going to rebuild our country is the basis for this. And then we build out from there. But for me, these construction jobs, these should be the gold standard that everybody wants to be part of.
Absolutely. The tax incentives in these bills, both the Inflation Reduction Act and our offshore wind bill here in Maine, the tax incentives are really significant to lead people to the high road when they're bidding on these projects.
So what kind of projects are happening in Maine? I know the wind, there's a lot of wind happening. Anything else going on in your state?
There's a lot of solar being built, and some of that started before we got rolling on these projects. So some of those jobs are not so good, but some of them are good and increasingly union, and we're aiming to trend them that way so that they support people and don't just use people. So lots of solar being built. We're leading an initiative through the Maine Labor Climate Council toward public buildings, schools in particular, for a retrofit for better energy, for better air. You know, it'll make a cleaner environment for people to work in. It'll use less energy. It'll save the district's money. So that's going to be really exciting. That project is in its infancy, but we're hoping that that's really going to take off and transform a lot of our public buildings into energy savers instead of expensive energy costs for town districts.
So what you're saying, what you're telling me is you're indoctrinating the children to like green energy.
We're hoping to convince the school boards as well, yes.
No, at the
and
end
yes,
of the day,
if children grow up with that, they're going to like it. It's going to be a good memory.
No, no. Look, we put solar panels on our house back in 12. And it's one of those things that my kids saw. And they started then questioning, you know, why doesn't our school have it? And then a couple years later, our school district put in a big array. And they were asking, you know, why doesn't the Walmart and the shopping mall and, you know, all this open, why don't we have solar panels everywhere, Dad? And I'm going, well, we just don't have the will yet. And maybe we will. Maybe this is going to move us in that direction.
Yeah, certainly some will was created to pass that bill because it wasn't easy, as you know, if you followed all the iterations it had to go through to finally come out and become real. But it takes people like your son asking those questions.
But, you know, here's the thing. And I go, you know, this is it's historic. It's moving us in a positive direction. But it's not enough. I mean, you know, and I know I sound greedy. I know I sound, you know, like I'm whining. But if we're going to truly transform this country for the future and give our children and grandchildren a country worth inheriting, I think we got to move a little quicker. We got to get a little step in the giddy up.
Yeah, well, you know, 4 years ago, Governor Mills said Maine won't wait when she talked about our climate plan. And again, you know, that's one of the things we're excited about in this offshore wind bill, because we were able to make it a lot bigger than it was going to be and with a much more ambitious timeline because of the conditions that were set by the Inflation Reduction Act. And you're right, it is just one of the things, but we have to do all of the things. And this was a really important one that we're really proud to be moving forward on, as well as the other things, programs that we've talked about.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Cynthia Finney. She's the president of the Maine AFL-CIO. You can check out their website, maineaflcio.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Now, the Inflation Reduction Act is a lot more than just the clean energy stuff. You know, prescription drugs, some talk about that, insulin. There's a bunch of things in there to try and bring costs down. And I know a state like Maine, an older state, a state that, you know, has some of these. How is this helping bring your inflation down? Because I look at Florida. Florida's going crazy with inflation. I don't know what they're doing down there, but wow. How are things going in Maine?
The numbers, but I do know that it's making a difference when people are making enough money to be able to afford things. I know things are leveling out. And I also know another thing that's in the bill is equity standards on some of this work, so that when contractors are providing jobs for folks who haven't traditionally been able to have them, and, you know, again, you know, a personal story, because that's where it's real, it's when it happens to a real person, is another one of these folks who came through our construction academy. He's from a Sudanese refugee family, grew up in the south of the United States, and I don't know how he ended up in Maine, but here he is. And he came through our pre-apprenticeship program. He's got just a strong sense of racial justice, and he's really excited to be working as an electrician in green energy. And those standards for equity provide additional, besides the benefits for if you follow the labor standards, then there's additional benefits that are available to contractors who also have diverse workforces and things like that. So we're also creating that kind of change in our society and really building, at the same time that we're building an economy that can support the climate and the planet, we're also building an economy that can get rid of the inequality, which I'm sure you've talked about many times on your show over the 18 years. So, and so all of this that raises up all the votes, helps with the inflation, helps with the cost, helps folks build lives that can flourish.
Yeah. Now, as I've been talking about on the show, if every working person in this country was a member of a labor union, the vast majority of contracts I know have some cost of living adjustment stuff in it. I know my grandparents in the 70s, they saw 1975, my grandfather got 3 raises because inflation kept going up and wages kept going up to meet that, because you know, you don't want your wages to be eroded. To me, this is one of the great talking points of why we should be joining and forming unions for all working people. And look, it's happening. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's a lot of activity, which is why I'm also thrilled to hear the NLRB is moving back to the good old days of the Joy Silk Doctrine, to where if you sign a union card and you got the majority, you start bargaining. None of this nonsense of being harassed and intimidated and threatened and fired. You start negotiating. You start bargaining for better wages, hours, condition. Again, this is why I voted for Joe Biden and why I think we're heading in the right direction.
Yeah, he's been a really strong leader on that.
So last question I've got for you. On the apprenticeship front, there are lots of opportunities. What should people do if they want to get their kids, my son wants to be an elevator mechanic. How do we get young people moving into those jobs?
Well, I know on our website, there's where you can sign up if you're interested in things like that. And I'm going to guess that other, because I know your show is not confined to Maine, so I'm going to guess that other AFL-CIOs around the country on their websites probably have ways to get in touch too. But that is a great place to start asking the questions. Who's the union? How do I contact the union? There are pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship programs for all kinds of construction trades, elevator constructors, operating engineers, laborers, electricians, carpenters, bricklayers. You know, they all have strong apprenticeship programs. They all have strong wage benefit packages. And you can start with your AFL-CIO to ask how to contact that. Many of them also have building and construction trade councils. You want to make sure it's the building and construction trade councils, because those are the union organizations, not the, you know,
not the ABC people.
The non-union contractors. Yeah.
No. Don't waste your time in an ABC apprenticeship program where the vast majority of people don't finish and end up getting inferior training. Again, there's not a better bang for the buck.
Specify registered. Yeah. Registered apprenticeship. You look for registered apprenticeship, and then it'll meet your state standards and not just be something that calls itself apprenticeship.
There you go. Cynthia, I appreciate you taking time for us. Keep up the great work. I look forward to talking to you again as we continue to expand the green energy universe. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Great to talk.
You as well. Cynthia Finney, president of the Maine AFL-CIO, maineaflcio.org, the website. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1985. That was the day that workers at the Hormel plant in Austin, Minnesota, went out on strike. They were members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local P9. Hormel had slashed workers' wages by 23% during the early 1980s. Benefits were also diminished and incentive programs rolled back. These changes cut deeply into the Hormel workers' earnings. What had been considered a good job was changing drastically. This was the story for many workers in Reagan-era America. The 3,500 Hormel workers voted overwhelmingly to strike. The National UFCW discouraged the action. The strike lasted more than a year. Strikebreakers were brought in, including some of the union members who crossed the picket line to return to work. The National Guard was called in to keep the peace between strikers and the scabs. After a year, the strike went down in defeat. Even after the strike, many of the workers were not called back to work. They were put on waiting lists for a job to reopen. Some never returned to the plant. 25 years after the strike, the Austin Daily Herald staff wrote, quote, "What resulted was a bitter, drawn-out labor dispute that drastically impacted the community, from workers who lost their jobs to families that were torn apart by the picket lines." The strike became the feature of a documentary by Barbara Koppel. In 1990, the documentary American Dream won the Academy Award.
The film tells the story of the Hormel strike as a window into the tragic experiences of many workers during the 1980s. The film was made on a shoestring budget. Singer Bruce Springsteen provided $25,000 to help support this important film.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Got an email that caught my attention, and again, it's another one of these. Yesterday was just a big email day that there were so many of them that I wanted to get to, and if I didn't get to yours, there's always tomorrow or the next day. But I got an email that said, "Hey Rick, I heard you talk about religious leaders and how they are losing their minds, and saw this story about Greg Locke smashing a Barbie house. Did you see it? Any thoughts?" And I didn't. She sent me this image of this pastor. One of the more famous right-wing zealoty kind of pastors, and he evidently wrapped a baseball bat with a Bible, and I'm not quite sure why. You know, it's one of those things where you're gonna use the Bible to bust up a Barbie house. Why? And evidently he spent time doing their show, whatever the song and dance is. You know, destroying this Barbie house. And again, you know, it's a movie, man. He's all worked up about a Barbie movie. And I guess it's because the Ken character acted a little feminine. I don't know. I haven't seen the movie, but I'm still trying to figure out why this matters that much. It's crazy. I mean, but I guess it's the time and the place in which we live in. But here's my another frustration. While we're distracted by this, while this is what someone writes me, and I appreciate it, thank you, we're still in a moment where our Republican leaders are doing nothing to help working families. And it used to be that Republicans were the party of the military. It used to be they were the party of national security, very paternalistic, you know, the law and order types. And you do know that Tommy Tuberville, the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate, is holding up the promotions of hundreds of military officers. And I guess we're three members short on the Joint Chief of Staff right now because Tuberville is holding all this stuff up. And Kyrsten Sinema, who I guess never finds a place where she doesn't want to butt her nose into, she decided today to call on the president and Tommy Tuberville to, you know, find common ground, you know, work this out, find some common ground, find the middle ground. This is why I hate Democrats sometimes, or Kyrsten Sinema, more likely. Now, remember, you know, Kyrsten was 100% prorated with Planned Parenthood and NARA and all the abortion groups. But, you know, hey, you know, we have to find middle ground. And what middle ground got us was a ban on overturning Roe. So never mind that. But this is the question I have is, what does she want Joe Biden to do? Now, remember, she's got 100% rating from Planned Parenthood and these other groups, a 0% rating from the anti-abortion groups or the pro-birth groups. What common ground? What should Joe Biden concede to get Tuberville to do his job? This is my problem with weak Democrats, because there's nothing that drives me crazier than weak and stupid. And we've got both here. We've got Sinema, who's weak, and we've got Tuberville, who's stupid. And when weak and stupid are running your government, you've got problems. And we do. We've got problems. And this is why I keep saying the reason that working class voters have moved over to Republicans, even though Republican policies are horrible for them, are destroying their families, are destroying their jobs, destroying their communities. Even though they're doing all that, they at least look tough. They at least look strong. They at least look like they're fighting for something. Granted, they're fighting to screw me over. Granted, they're fighting to make sure my kids don't get an education, but they're fighting. And it's one of these things where you just go, what is it that's got you on there? It's angering and it's frustrating. But this is the place that we're in. Oh, we got Lewis online too. Let's go to Lewis. I got about a minute. Lewis, how are you, man?
I'm doing all right. How you doing, Rick?
Good. What's on your mind? Go.
Since I'm short on time, I want to say that, you know, this discussion is really interesting. And I want to just kind of add a little something to the discussion about, you know, how to unify the working class. And, you know, the dominant narrative is one in which the Democrats lost the white working class because they went radically left and started social liberalism and stuff.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.